The fish volunteers that we're referring to in our discussion today refers to an emergency aid organization that's manned entirely by volunteers. Its beginnings and its background are very well presented in a book by the Reverend Robert Howell called Fish for My People. Other useful books about fish are the one titled The Fish, A Ministry of Love, and it describes what happened after the first book was written, especially the fish stories that Reverend Howell collected. I corresponded with him when he was writing this book, and he told me about some of the things he was trying to gather, and we sent him some information from our fish chapter, some of our more interesting experiences as a volunteer organization. He collected these and put them into a book describing the volunteer organization. One that you might be particularly interested in is one by Philip Deemer, and it's called Starting a Local Fish Chapter. When we began, nothing like this was available, and so we had to learn by experience. However, in this book, Philip Deemer gives you the benefit of the experiences of many groups trying to start a fish chapter. It deals with such things as getting started, recruiting and training volunteers, setting up a schedule, promoting fish in the community, expenses and fundraising, providing transportation, visiting and companionship, considering incorporation and insurance, and the role of prayer in maintaining a fish group. And these are available from the international organization. Fish for My People is published by Morehouse Barlow Company. The Fish, A Ministry of Love, and Starting a Local Fish Chapter are published by Gerald Press Incorporated, and both sell for $2.50. Another thing that's very helpful once you establish a chapter is the fish directory. It contains a compendium of information of all of the other fish chapters throughout the world. And we often found that this was useful in referring people in our area to a fish chapter if we were sending them on to a different city. A further aid is the Fish International Newsletter. It's a bi-monthly printed newsletter giving information on major developments in fish chapters throughout the world. It gives such information as what should be in an article of incorporation, information on insurance, and it usually contains a column by Father Howell, who was the founder of Fish in the United States. And a column to which many people contribute is called Boulevays, in which the local chapters share with other chapters what they've been doing. And it's a good source of ideas for your own fish chapter. In answer to the question, what is fish, if you haven't been connected with a fish chapter, it might be useful to give some background information. Along the shores of the Sea of Galilee, Jesus came upon two brothers, Peter and Andrew, and said to them, "Follow me, and I will make you fishers of men." Since that time, many people have been trying to follow Christ as fishers of men. Some people have succeeded in doing this through fish. Fish is a movement of individuals working together in local chapters, performing services, often emergency services, but not always, for their fellow men. It started in 1961 when a small group of people in St. Andrew's Church, Old Headington, Oxford, England, sought to follow Christ and minister to their neighbors. A person was selected to be a street warden and to watch out for the well-being of the people on his street. Fish cards were distributed to all of the homes on each street, something like this, only a little larger, and people placed this card in their window when they needed some help. When the local street warden saw the fish card in the window, he immediately went to the house. The fish symbol was chosen because it was a sign, an early identifying symbol of Christianity, and meant you are among friends. An American visiting in England several years later learned of the program and brought its story back to the United States, and this person was the Reverend Robert Howell, who was at that time rector of the Church of the Good Shepherd in West Springfield, Massachusetts. In that parish, a small group was already meeting regularly during Lent in 1964. At the end of Lent, Father Howell preached a sermon about establishing fish in the parish, and shortly five people joined him and his wife in initiating the first fish chapter in the United States. Today there are more than 2,000 chapters throughout America and the world. And fish operates basically by telephone rather than by the signs in the windows, because it is just a more successful means of operation in our large and small communities. However, the premise remains the same, namely being fishers of men. Fish has no national structure, and I believe very strongly this is one of its good points, because you aren't involved in a lot of red tape. Each local chapter sets up its own organization and ministers to the needs of its particular community, and you're not bound by the rules of a larger organization. However, they do have a central office where they publish the fish newsletter, and this can serve as a source of information and dissemination of information, but it does not serve as a controlling device. The services which fish are called upon to perform are varied. It can mean taking a child from school to the hospital. It can mean putting a person in contact with the right agency for obtaining medical assistance. It can mean reading to a blind person. It can mean running a ham radio service to contact family members in another area where there's been a disaster. It can mean securing overnight lodging for someone who is stranded in a strange town. It can mean giving assistance to someone who finds himself the victim of civic red tape. It can mean telephoning an elderly person once a day to check that that person is all right and not in need. This is a service that we found in our area was very much appreciated for people who wanted to maintain their own homes but had no family around them. It can mean doing housework or preparing meals for someone recuperating from an illness or where the mother is in the hospital. It can mean running an errand for an invalid. It's meant these and many more things in our local chapter and in other chapters that I've read about through the Fish newsletter. When I talk about fish in my own experience, I'm talking about our experiences in establishing a chapter in a university town in a rural area of eastern Washington. The population of the town is about 21,000 people. When school is in session. When it's not in session, it drops back minus the 16,000 students who are generally in the town. So it deals with, at times, what is a somewhat sophisticated community, and other times it reaches out to the rural parts around the community. One of the first questions that we ask when we were thinking of forming a fish chapter is, why? What are the reasons for starting such an emergency aid group? And we found that there were both practical and theological reasons. The theological reasons were very well stated by the Reverend Robert Howell in his book, Fish for My People. In the first instance, he stated, "The fish may seem to be too simple for our complex world. Then we need to think it through again. The church is here as the agent of Christ, his body, to be an enabler of men for living more fully. We believe a man lives more completely, works more effectively, solves complicated problems with greater skill, is more human when he knows that he is loved by someone enough to come to him when he needs help. That is what the Lord did for us, and now he seems to have given the job to us. We are committed to him and have found the fish an effective means of expressing our commitment." And the people who worked with me and who were most strongly committed to fish were committed for theological reasons and were not the kind of do-gooder that many people associate with aid organizations. There's a second theological basis, and the Reverend Howell explained it this way. "The fish ministry is fully meaningful to its workers only if it is thoroughly grounded in faith. Knowing that God loves us and that we can express our gratitude to him only if we love our neighbor keeps us from being a do-good organization without any base. We are fishers of men who realize that life can sometimes be sustained by something as small as a cup of water given in silence with simplicity." And this is something in our chapter that we tried to maintain, and that's as much simplicity as possible, to avoid getting entangled in red tape and entangling other people in red tape. But there were also practical reasons, I guess some would say more practical than the theological reasons, why we established a fish chapter in our area. We found, for the first reason, that rapid growth and constant mobility meant that many strangers were living close together. In a community town, we noticed this mobility particularly. There was a little sense of neighborhood in many areas of our town, even though it was a town of only 21,000 people. And I imagine this sense is magnified if you come from a large city. You can move into an area where there's very little sense of, this is my neighbor and I can go to him for help. And there were a few long-established friendships, except in very certain areas of the town, maybe only a street where a lot of people had lived for quite a while. We found that relatives were distant, especially for the married students, when they needed a mother or mother-in-law. New people didn't know where to go when emergencies arose, or just for information about the services already available in our town. A second problem is our lack of public transportation. This is a great hardship in our town, especially for older people, because the city is built on a series of hills. And those who couldn't afford a taxi or those who were too handicapped to drive had no way to go to the doctor, to get groceries, to go to the visit friends at the convalescent center, and so on. Even with a public transportation system, which we are thinking of inaugurating, our services will still be needed by blind students, by the elderly people with rheumatism who need assistance in getting in and out of vehicles. So I think that's a need that certainly is not going to change. We also found in our area that there was a great deal of loneliness among the elderly and the isolated rural families. So this is a problem that we tried to address in our FISH group. And also, it's inevitable that emergencies will occur in any income bracket. There are always human problems that are too small for an agency to handle. And FISH is just the right kind of an organization, because what we always said is that we offer people. We don't offer money. We don't offer forms to fill out. We offer people who will give up their own time and go out and help other people. And in this way, we fit into the cracks between areas where agencies would take over. And this is one of our main reasons for existing. I thought it might be useful to talk about exactly how we established the FISH group. And this might serve as a model for other communities, and any of you who have experience in other communities might add to this. FISH in Pullman began when five people got together and talked about the necessity for having some kind of an aid organization. This was in the fall of 1970. Next, they went to seek seed money from Church Women United in our town, which provided, I think, $100 to get us started. And we also found a woman who was willing to add another $100, and this provided all the money that we needed to get our chapter going. After that, the next step was to announce a public meeting of everyone who was interested in a FISH chapter. And it's interesting that this all occurred shortly after a number of articles had appeared about FISH chapters. One appeared in the local newspaper about a chapter. It was actually a Spokane paper, and it described a chapter in another area. And then the Lutheran Journal appeared that month with a story about FISH. And that's how I got interested in it. I remember reading that story, and I remember feeling myself in Pullman very much alone. When we first moved there, we moved into an area of town which was inhabited mostly by single students. We knew no one in the community. We found that the area where we were located was very unfriendly. Not too long after that, we were expecting a child. We had no one we were close to with whom we could leave our other children while I was in the hospital, so my husband could come with me. And it occurred to me as I looked around that there were a lot of other people feeling this way. They didn't know where to go in town to get help, and they didn't have close friends that they could turn to. At any rate, the five people who were originally interested announced through the church bulletins and in the newspapers that there would be a public meeting of people who were interested in forming such a chapter, and this was held in the basement of one woman's home, and we had about 30 people who came. And that night, these people formed the nucleus of our particular FISH chapter. We assigned duties as far as organizing the chapter, decided how we were going to operate, and then went out to look for more volunteers. Eventually, we had about 125 people who formed our steady group of volunteers. And we found that both men and women were necessary for the successful working of the chapter. In many cases, husband and wife teams work together. Don and I were always on duty together. And we found this to be very useful, because there are some situations in which men are very helpful. And unfortunately, many FISH chapters have mostly women as their components, and we felt that ours was much richer for the men who were willing to come and participate, and many times the things that needed doing could best be done by men. We also had all ages join. We had people from high school age through retired people, and some of our best workers are retired people who find in this a sense of being needed and a sense of a way in which they contribute to the community. We had people from all backgrounds, farmers, businessmen, housewives, students, and university personnel. And it was a very interesting thing to watch, the manner in which people who ordinarily were very separate in our community could come together in an emergency situation and work. You could have a university professor, a downtown businessman working together, or a farmer. And this sense of community was something that grew as the chapter was established, and we worked with people from many churches. We found that as we came to the community, we became very wrapped up in just our own Lutheran church. And as a result of this, our experiences with FISH, we met people from other churches who were exemplary Christians and who broadened our circle of friends and contacts and people that we became very close to over the years. Our primary source of volunteers was the churches. We had other people who volunteered, but it was interesting watching over the years when I was president of FISH, the people who could be counted on for the most staying power were generally people who came with a theological commitment to the organization. And they stayed in there when the going got a little rough and when it was inconvenient to do the things that needed to be done or when there was a lot of hard work to be done. There were certain people that we could pick out, that we could count on, and these are people who felt a very strong Christian commitment to what they were doing. We had people join by signing a commitment form indicating their areas of interest. I have some examples here, which I'll pass around. You see at the top our FISH symbol and a quick explanation of who, what, when, for whom, and how, just what FISH is about. And then the question, will you be a FISH? And then on the FISH commitment form, they signed their name, address, whether they had a car, what they wanted to do, and where their particular areas of expertise were. You'll notice at the top that the people in our community found it somewhat difficult to put up with the name FISH because people just don't know what it is when they first hear it. But it was a name that was part of the organization, and we didn't feel we could change it. We had people call and ask, you know, what do I do for a sick guppy? Because they thought it was some kind of an informational organization for tropical fish. So they decided to make FISH an acronym, and a number of other places have done this. So they put on the sign for immediate sympathetic help, and that helped them to explain when people asked why FISH. They gave that acronym, and that helped to solve some of the problem. So you might be interested in just looking at the form.
And do you have enough that we could keep one?
Right, if you'd like to keep one, that would be fine. After they joined the commitment form, the person was given a packet containing information on the local organization. It contained a schedule, a procedure list, a backup list, a membership list, and a referral directory. And I'll give you examples of each of these. I brought some with me. We also, at first we thought it was enough to give a new member a packet. One of our members of the board would go to the new member and say, here, would you read this? This is what it means to be part of our organization. And in the university community, we tended to rely very heavily on people's ability to read and figure it out for themselves. We found that people oftentimes don't read what you give them until the emergency comes up and then they wish that they had read it. So after the first year, we instituted training sessions for new members at intervals whenever a number, usually the fall was a big joining time when new people came into town. And I have with me some information that I would always disseminate at information training sessions to make them more aware of how our group operates, because one of the things that we emphasized was that it was not a red tape organization. It was not a kind of organization where you were going to be expected to go to meetings incessantly. We had one meeting a year, and that was all. And everything else was carried on by means of a newsletter communication or telephone communication. And this appealed to a lot of people because they were fed up with going to meetings and sitting for endless hours listening to things that they thought could have been taken care of in 5 minutes. And so these people were very much impressed by the fact that they weren't expected to attend a lot of meetings in order to be part of FISH. As far as the operation of the chapter is concerned, we had two people on duty at all times in shifts throughout the day. And this is evident in the scheduling. I have some copies of old schedules here that might be useful in explaining this. You'll see that the hours are here. We have what's called a listening fish and a working fish on duty at all times. And the shifts are 8 a.m. to 12:30 p.m., 12:30 p.m. to 5, 5 to 8 a.m. the next morning, and or 5 to 11 or 5 to 8 a.m., depending on how we could get people to take the evening shift. Some would take it from 5 p.m. to 8 a.m. all the way through, and others from 5 p.m. to 11, and then the next shift would be 11 at night to 8 the next morning. This was Monday through Friday. On Saturdays and Sundays, we found it was more effective to get people to sign up by the first, they would take maybe the first Saturday every month, or the second Saturday every month, or the first Sunday, or the second Sunday, and they would be on duty the whole day, and they would make it a point just to stay home for that one Saturday every month and be on duty. We also had a service sorority in town that wanted a service project. So after a while, they took over all of the Saturdays, and they would assign members of their sorority to duty on those Saturdays. So this seemed to work out pretty well for us. The listening fish is the one who receives the emergency call. There are a number of ways of setting up this call reception. Some chapters have found that they give one phone number that's always available, and they have maybe a hotel where the person on duty is willing to transfer the call onto the home of the volunteer. Some people have maybe an invalid in the community that wants to do this as a service, and they give their number, and this person takes the call and transfers it on to the volunteer. In our community, neither of these seem to work well, seem to as though they would fit, so we got an electronic secretary from the phone company. And we had a person on our board who every morning would go and put on the tape the numbers of the people who would be on duty for these times. And she would say, this is the FISH Volunteer Organization. If you need help, please call the following number depending upon the time. Monday from 8 a.m. to 12:30 p.m. call, and then she would repeat the number twice. From 12:30 to 5, call. And then usually there were three numbers on there at a time. From 5 to 11 the next morning, call. And she would repeat the number twice. So the person knew the FISH number, would call and would get this recording and would write down the number and then would place a second call to the person who was on duty as a listening FISH. And very often these were people who, for one reason or another, were homebound. Women with young children were our chief volunteers in this area. And that meant that they could stay home and do things with their children and take care of their house, but still have something to contribute. All right, the listening fish would get the call and listen and find out what was needed. In some cases, all that was needed was a referral to an agency in town that could handle this particular service, which is the reason for our referral directory, which I'll show you in a moment. Sometimes it would mean something would have to be done. Someone would call and say, my child has cut his finger. My husband isn't home with the car. I've got to get the child to the hospital. And so this listening fish would take the address, take the number, and immediately call the counterpart on duty at the same time called the working fish. And this is a person who said, during this time period, I have a car available, and I'm able to leave at a moment's notice to go and help someone. So this person would then immediately go and do whatever was necessary. This was our basic system, and it seemed to work very well. In some instances, we'd get people in payphones who didn't have enough money to call two numbers, and we found that the telephone operators were very helpful, because if they just called the operator and said, I'm out of money, I need to call this emergency number, she would put them through, and that's something we appreciated very much. The thing we didn't appreciate very much is that the phone company will not give you anything but a business phone when you're in an organization like this. And for over a period of 4 years, the president's fish would go down every year and argue with the phone company on this point and say, we're not a business organization. We're a nonprofit, charitable kind of organization. Can't you give us a different phone rate? And they would always insist that we had to pay the business phone rate of $40 or $45 a month. And that was our biggest expense. And we never were able to shake them from this conviction that we had to pay for a business phone. We had the phone located in the office of the Methodist Church. It was underneath the counter back in a little cupboard because they never had to answer it. We would have our person come in, make the tape each day. The phone would ring. It would automatically go on to the tape. And so they had really no connection with it, except that they offered this space for us to make the phone available. One of the things that we found most useful as we established our chapter is to put together a referral directory of all the services in our community. And I was surprised how little I knew about our community till we had to put together a referral directory of everything that's offered in any area. And we put together listings under the aged, armed services and veterans, child care and nursery schools, children and youth assistance, counseling, employment, family assistance, foreign languages, health services, handicaps, hobbies and activities for adults, housing, legal services, maternity help and premarital pregnancy, traveler's assistance, youth programs, and then a miscellaneous section, and got together every resource we could possibly find in our community, in our county, even in distant communities if they would send resource people to our community. And I'll pass around some examples of these. I sent those in that way. It was interesting that after we had done this in 1970 in our community, there had not been anything like this before. And people began to take notice and ask for copies of our referral directory. And it got to the point where we couldn't afford to copy them anymore, so we had to start charging people because there were so many organizations that wanted to find out what services were available in our community. And as a matter of fact, about 3 years later, the Department of Social and Health Services in our county found that this kind of a directory would be useful, so they put together one for the entire county. And we worked a deal where we would help them put it together, and then they would supply enough copies of this for the members of our organization. So this is one of the good spin-offs of our particular organization, in that it made the rest of the community aware of the importance of knowing where all of the services are, whereas before only a few caseworkers in the Department of Social and Health Services would have all this information. Also, we try to include in our packet that we give to volunteers any other information about the community that might be useful. For example, one that describes things in our particular town, or a guidebook to child care services in our town, which is put together by the child care committee in our city. Also, we found that our Chamber of Commerce put together a list of the members, the presidents of all the clubs in our area. So anything like this that was useful, we tried to include in our packet to provide information to the listening fish, because a good many of our calls that came in, people would just say, you know, I'm in trouble, where can I go to get a pregnancy test? And we could look in there and say, this is where you go, these are the hours that they're open, there's no charge, and it put their minds greatly at ease just to have this kind of specific information. We had a membership list on which we had all the names, addresses, and phone numbers of all of the people who belonged to FISH, and then we had the membership list divided up into categories. We had the people who were regular listening and working FISH, those who were willing to substitute for these people. We have the backup FISH, and then we had people who'd volunteered in various categories. For example, on this list, you'll find the names of people who are particularly good at child care or babysitting, those who will help with food preparation, those who are willing to work with the elderly, those who are willing to go out and do housework for people who need help. And so when a working FISH got a request for someone, say a mother had gone to the hospital and the family needed someone to prepare food for that evening, it would be too much maybe for one person, she would go to the food preparation list and say, all right, I'll call this person and this person. All right, you, would you do the dessert, you do the salad, you do the main course, I'll come around and collect them and we'll take them all over at 6. And in order to keep the top people from being used all the time on each of these lists, we put the note on, please call the person whose name begins with your initial first, then continue alphabetically down the list. So that way you broke into the list at various places. So the first one I would call on here would begin with an H, and so on. So that way everybody had more of a chance of getting used. And these were documents that were found in the packet. We also found that we needed a list of babysitters and people who would do housework for pay, because our organization was meant to be an emergency aid organization, and some people would call just because they couldn't find a babysitter and were quite willing to pay for a sitter. And one of the rules of the FISH organization as a nonprofit tax-exempt organization is that we do not charge for any of our services. And so we would refer them to people who we knew to be good babysitters and reliable people and who would charge them then for their services. As far as our structure is concerned, we operate with an 8-member board of directors who are also the officers of the FISH organization, and these people are unpaid volunteers. Their duties are described in our bylaws when we became incorporated. When we first began, we operated strictly as a local organization and without any particular legal implications, but it became evident to us there were a number of benefits of becoming incorporated as a tax-exempt organization. For one thing, people who wanted to give donations to our organization could then take an income tax exemption, which meant something to them. Also, we could get a less expensive mailing, bulk mailing rate as a tax-exempt organization. And we found it useful just to put down in the very simplest form what it was that we were trying to do in our organization. And so we put together bylaws that, as you'll see, are double-spaced, only 4 pages, and have the bare-bones structure of the organization. And I'd be glad to get copies of these for any of you who might be interested. Basically, our board of directors consisted of a president, a vice president, a secretary, a treasurer, an assistant treasurer, a membership chairman, a log keeper. And this log keeper was the person who supervised the electronic tape, which kept the numbers for each of the days, and a publicity chairman. And we found this to be a very effective-sized working group if each member was willing to pull his or her weight. We held one general meeting a year. Lately, we've been holding two because people ask for another one. They say, well, I would like to know the person on the other end of the line that I talk to all the time. So we have just one social meeting, which is not an obligatory meeting, and then we have one organizational meeting a year for the election of officers and for handling the official business of the organization. We always try to keep in front of us the goal of the organization, which is to put people who want help in touch with those who want to give help. The budget of our organization is supported entirely by individual organizational contributions. We tried to get each of the churches in town to commit themselves to a monthly pledge to the organization, even as little as $5 a month, so that we could count on making our basic phone bill and mailing expenses. We tried to keep a very small emergency aid fund, but we always emphasized that what we wanted to do was to provide people to give help, and we were not going to give out sums of money. And we never had the sums of money to give out, so it was never a problem. But we always emphasized that it was a people-oriented organization, and we did not have a lot of money. If you have any questions, any time here, feel free to ask them. All right, after we decided to form our organization, the next problem was, how do we let the community know what we're going to do? Well, one of the ways we let the community know was to publish a flyer like this, in which we explained what we would do. And we had enough of these made up for every house in the city. And we had volunteers, Boy Scouts, Girl Scouts, others, who would go around and distribute these flyers to every house in the city. And that was quite a massive undertaking, but it was effective for a beginning for a town our size. We also had these posted on bulletin boards in churches, in stores, in places where they have swap boards, things for sale, any place where we thought people would be able to see it. And then another thing we had were posters. We had people who were particularly talented in that area make up full large posters of about 3 feet maybe. and post those in particularly conspicuous places. And we found that most of our calls as a result of the poster came from the Greyhound bus station, where people would come in, get off the bus, and come with a multitude of woes many times. And they would see our sign there got so it was very dog-eared and spotted and had to be replaced frequently. But that was one of the most effective places to put such a sign. We also put spot public service announcements over our TV and radio stations. And we offered people on our board to give talks in churches. A number of us gave talks before Kiwanis and various civic groups explaining our purpose and seeking contributions and support. We also made it a point to go and talk to the power organizations in town. In our town, there's a local welfare committee. And we wanted to assure them that the purpose of our organization was not to encroach on their territory in any way, that we wanted to do the kind of things that they were unable to do. They had the money resources to take care of fuel bills, to provide clothing for children and so forth that we didn't have, but they didn't have people who would go out and help other people. So we made a point of talking to them and explaining to them what we were going to do, and it took a couple of years before we won the confidence of the established people in town. But they saw that what we were doing was something entirely different from what they offered. We also talked to the people from the Department of Social and Health Services, and they came to rely very much on our organization as welfare families were in need of clothing or household utensils. We had people who were particularly skilled at finding these things and getting them donated. So basically, we tried to let them know what help was available and how they could get it. We also gave the talks to seek volunteers and then to seek financial support. Right after the community knew what was happening, the calls began to come in. And in our community, we found that on an average, at least one person a day was helped through the organization, which may not seem like a lot, but we talked about this quite a bit. You know, how much is enough to make a viable organization? And these are 365 people who otherwise would have been without help if the organization had not been there. And it was hard always to keep track of how many calls we had. We had a system whereby we attempted very much to maintain the confidentiality of the people who called. If it was not necessary, we didn't ask for their name and their address and their phone number. Sometimes people would call and they just needed somebody to talk to. And we talked to people on the phone sometimes for an hour or two. Don and I would sort of spell off and talk to them. And it was never necessary to know their name. However, in some instances where we had to take them food or something like this, then we did have to know their name. At any rate, we asked that each person who received a call keep a 3x5 card by their phone. And on this card, they wrote the information about the call and transmitted it to the president. And this information was always considered confidential, but we felt it was very crucial to have a record of the kinds of calls that were coming in, because that's the only way we could keep track of how much the service was being used, what kinds of things were being asked for, and whether or not there were a few instances where the organization might be being used. In trying to avoid red tape, you always run into that hazard. You know, there are many people who warned us, you're going to be used. You don't ask enough questions. You don't make them fill out a form. You don't make them state their total assets. You don't make them do anything. They call up and they say, I need some food. I need some gas for my car. I'm traveling through town. And so we would go and we would take them food and we would give them gas. And we found in the 2 years that I was served as president of FISH, I think there were only two instances where we possibly could have been used by people who were not really in need. And that is a very small percentage of the time. And I felt that even if we were used in those couple of instances, it was worth it not to be asking all the questions and putting people off with red tape and making them fill out forms in order to be assisted. Because one thing that sold our organization to the people who called was the openness of the people who were willing to come out and help them. We didn't ask a lot of questions. And I still think that's a good policy. I have people who argue against that kind of a policy, but for us, I thought it worked very well. The question is, once you have the group going, how are you going to sustain it? Because if any of you have experience in working with volunteers, you know they don't have to do anything. They don't have to do what they're doing. They're doing it because they want to. And how are you going to keep up the interest that the people have in this particular organization? One of the best ways to keep them involved is to let them know what's happening. If any of you serve as presidents of an organization like this, you find that you get so wrapped up in everything that's happening. As president, I always knew what was going on. The cards were coming to me, and I was sort of the last resource person. When they didn't know what to do, the people would call me all hours of the night and day and say, you know, I just don't know what to do with this call. And it was kind of exciting because Don and I would answer the phone. You never knew what was going to happen next. And even our kids got involved in going out and helping people. And it was a really good family situation. But we were so wrapped up in it that we were always excited about it. But there were people out there in the organization who didn't know what was going on. They might get one call a week and wonder, you know, are we really doing any good? And that's where I think the really crucial element is to keep in contact with your volunteers. And we did this through a newsletter. I have a series of some of our old newsletters here that you might find interesting to look at. But it just, you know, things to know. Here are changes in our schedule. Here are some new sources of food. And here are some of the things we've done lately. And we worded these very carefully so that we didn't give away names. In a small town, you have to be very careful because even describing the situation can identify people. So we chose, for examples, those things which were not likely to violate the confidentiality of the organization. But that's really crucial that people know that we're doing something important. You know, hang in there. You didn't get called today, but next week, you know, it'll probably be you. So these are some of the things that we're doing. And so I think that kind of contact is really crucial if you're going to keep a volunteer in your organization. And you have to stress, I think, when the new volunteers come in, that you don't say, well, you really won't have much to do. You have to stress that if you want to join our organization, we expect that you're going to be there the hours you say you're going to be there. And we expect that you're going to be willing to get up and to go and do something, all right? So you just had company come in, all right? You're on duty for these hours. If you don't have a substitute, you're it. You know, we expect you to go and do what you said you would do. And I think people respond well to that. If they know ahead of time, this is what's expected of them. You know, it's not very meaningful to belong to an organization where you're told you really don't have to do very much. We really don't need you very much. And we try to make our volunteers feel that we do need you a lot. It's important that you're there at the times that you're signed up for. And if you get a call, don't tell your listening fish, I'm just too busy this morning. You know, I've got them off the floor. I've got to do these other things. We're expecting that when you sign that commitment form, you're going to go. And so you go. We found it's very helpful in forming an organization like this to be flexible, to be adaptable in your program. For one thing, we added a mobile meals program several years after we started our organization because we became aware through the calls that were coming into us that there were a number of elderly people living alone in the community who were eating very poorly, who had very inadequate diets, who didn't have the resources to go out to eat, who didn't have the inclination to cook meals for themselves. Sometimes they didn't have the ability. They were just on that near edge of going into a nursing home, but they wanted to maintain their own individual domicile. So by adding a mobile meals program, we extended the dimensions of our organization greatly and offered a service to the community, which is still very much needed. And this meant that we had to get people who every day of the week would go and pick up hot meals at noon and take them out to people who needed them. So this is a kind of commitment that you can't put behind you and forget for a day. And the brochure that I'm handing around now describes the process whereby we worked the mobile meals program. Here we worked in conjunction with the local council on aging, who took care of the money part of it. And then we worked in conjunction with the local convalescent center who cooked the food. And when they couldn't do it, we worked with the public schools and used their noon lunches. But sometimes we found they weren't too suitable for elderly people. They didn't care for the corn dogs and some of the things that the kids thought were really neat. And the convalescent center proved to have a better diet as far as being a balanced menu that appealed to older people. But by working in conjunction with these other organizations, we provided the people to get the hot meals and deliver them. And we found that this was much more than just delivering a meal, because when you go and knock on the door, that person has sometimes been looking forward all day to you bringing that meal into the house. And the people found that they couldn't deliver a lot of meals at noon, because every place they stopped, the people expected them to come in and talk, because that was as important as the food they brought, was the companionship that they could give to these people. So the most they could deliver sometimes was two, because the others would get cold. They didn't want to say, well, I can't talk to you now, I'm too busy, because that would really deflate the people who'd been sitting there and waiting for that company. So I think an important part of our mobile meals program is the contact that we have with the elderly people and the friendships that have developed as a result of this. We also found that by being adaptable, this meant we had to drop things when they were no longer needed, because one of the rules of the fish organization is don't duplicate. When we first started up, our community was lacking in a lot of resources. Well, after we started, people began to see the need for a crisis center. So one was developed, and this crisis center had specially trained people who were trained by the university personnel in psychology, and they could handle crisis suicide type calls, which are always a kind of fright to people on our staff because we just weren't trained to handle them. You need a person who's specially trained to handle somebody who calls up and says, you know, I'm going to kill myself tonight. And that was one of the fears that we had in getting new volunteers. They said, well, what if I get a call like this? What am I going to do? So we really pushed for the establishment of a crisis center. So when a call like that came through, we could put it immediately through to people who were trained to handle it. This crisis center had what they called their flying squad. They were people trained to go out immediately on drug crisis problems. And this was a real problem in our university community when we started. There were certain pastors in town who were always called out of bed in the middle of the night to handle these drug crisis calls, and they were pleading for somebody, please, to get into this area. And we couldn't handle it, and we finally got a crisis center established where people could handle it, and it was a great relief to be able to refer people to those who were specially trained to help them in this area. Another thing when you establish a chapter is that you have to be flexible enough to realize when you're not needed anymore. And when we first established our chapter, we were very much needed in the community. There were none of the organizations like the Crisis Center and others that have since developed. However, since the time that we've established our chapter, the university community got together and established a referral center. They established a sex counseling center, a pregnancy counseling center. They established the crisis center. There have been a whole host of helping organizations that have come into being since our organization was founded. And I think some of them have come into being as a result of our organization, because people became aware of the great needs in these other areas, whereas before they said, well, you know, our town isn't big enough to need these things. And we were able to document that we did need these things because of the kind of calls that we were getting. And so when each of these things started up and became a viable unit, we backed off in that area and simply became a referral agency in that area. And we would open up something like in the mobile meals area. So you have to be able to sort of go with the times. You know, you can't be inflexible and say, well, this is our territory, you can't come in and do this. If you find people who want to do these things, we encourage them to do them, and then we back off in that area and look around and try to be aware in our community of where else we can be of service. And it also is a problem in the keeping of volunteers. This is a somewhat sensitive area, because you ask for all kinds of volunteers. You ask for anybody who wants to come and help. And the more you get into volunteerism, the more you begin to look at the kinds of people who volunteer their services. And it's a hard thing when you're in the executive role in a volunteer organization, because you have to kind of sort out the volunteers. And you notice the ones who might come in for less than charitable reasons, who come in for a kind of self-aggrandizement. It's a hard thing to say in a volunteer organization that there are some people that you really don't want to use too much. But I think if you're going to be in an executive role in a fish organization or one like that, you have to take a hard look at the people who are working for you and try to find their special talents. A lot of times they aren't in the areas where they say they are. They may say that they're very good at this or that. And as you get to know them, you find that maybe this person is not good as a listening fish because the person is too directive. They tend to say, well, I would do this and do that and do that. They don't listen enough. They want to have all the answers and all the solutions. So you try to find somewhere else where that person can be of service and not do harm to the people who are calling you. It's a difficult area, and it's an area where we could probably spend a lot of time in talking about the experiences we've had in dealing with difficult problems and with the volunteer-caller relationship. But I think one of the best sources of information on what do you tell a volunteer who wants to get involved in something like this comes from the book Fish for My People by Robert Howell. And he says this to the people in Fish. Most of the requests we get will require simple acts of kindness and concern, and none of you need training for that. But part of your work will be to listen and to enter into relationship with people who are experiencing a crisis, great or small. And he gives a number of aids. I won't go into all of them now, but here are some of them. One, help each person to become independent of us as soon as possible. Two, we shall need to learn to distinguish between our feelings and the feelings of the person that we are with. Three, be yourself with the people who call for your help, because they're calling because they need another person. Just be another person. Be yourself. Four, learn to listen. Our tendency may be to talk too much, especially if we're nervous. Learn to listen attentively and to find out what's really hurting the people who are calling you. And if you go to visit people, he gives you some tips on how long the visit should be. How do you know when it's time to get up and go? A sixth area, he gives characteristics of some of the people who call so that you feel more at home after reading this and looking at some of the calls that he had experienced in his fish chapter. And seventh, he said, we need to be open in our manner to build a relationship characterized by mutual respect, attentiveness, trust, and growth. Eighth, each of us needs to be aware of various roles we may be tempted or expected to take in an encounter. And he gives such things as the scapegoat, the judge, the cuddler, and so on. And we found all of these over the years in our fish contact, and he gives some good practical advice on how to handle these. And another important point he makes is learn how to make and when to make referrals. And that's where the referral directory is really crucial. If there are people in your community who are willing and anxious to serve in a particular area, who have expertise, send the people to them. That's where you'll be doing the biggest favor to them. And his final admonition is, remember, most of our calls will be for simple acts of neighborliness which require no training other than common sense. And we found that to be pretty much true in the kind of things that we've had to deal with in our fish organization. I also have here some examples of the Fish International newsletter from the years when I was president of our fish group. You'll notice the dates, 73 and 74. You might find these interesting because they show you some of the scope of the fish organization throughout the United States, problems and so on of the various organizations. Now, if you'd like any more detailed information, I have what I say at our fish training sessions, what I say to our new volunteers about how we work and what we should look for in working, and examples of some of the problems and calls that we've had. However, this may be too detailed, so I'll just sort of open it up and see if you have any questions. Would you like to hear about some of the kinds of calls that we have? This might be.
One of, let me put here.
Okay.
Usually, someone would arrive in Pullman at the Greyhound Depot, or drive into town, the car sputtering to a stop, they'd hit the phone, Linda would pick up the call, and I would be the one then, usually on a Friday night, 11, 12 o'clock at night, would be downtown. Now my first task was really to size up the situation. You know, what sort of need is here? And one of the things I became very, very conscious of in listening to other people talk, not everybody can handle just sort of people that end up needing help. Oftentimes, they are not the most beautiful, the most lovable, the neatest sides of humanity. You know, they're pretty low down, and this is one of the problems, particularly that can be overcome through fish with the theological commitment. And the second thing, of course, is the fact that we're able to function where the social or governmental agencies can't, because we had one couple call, or they had an next-door neighbor call from one of the several very ornery trailer courts in town, and these people, for at least 2 days, had not had a single lick of food in the house. And they had gone down to welfare, and Washington State Welfare at that time had a waiting date of 2 weeks. Okay, so they had no food in the house, and the welfare worker says, okay, come back in 2 weeks.
Well, it's about 10 days, I think it was 10 days, to process their application.
Yeah.
Now, they've since, because of many complaints, and we were among the complainers, have established a policy of emergency money that's available to help carry people over this period, but for a while there was no emergency money to carry people over.
Yeah. And this is time and time again, you see, is one of the very, very difficult dimensions of anything governmental. But anyway, I'd end up going down and sizing up the nature of the need, so that we could, if it was a matter of a sailor on the way home from Lewiston, or to Lewiston, Idaho, from Mississippi, and he'd been rolled in Helena, Montana. He'd thumbed, got a ride with a lettuce truck, all things. And I don't know how in the world he did it, but he ended up back in Pullman. He's 40 or 50 miles away from home. That's easily done. We took him home. We put him on the downstairs couch. He hadn't slept for around 3 days and 2 days, 3 days, 2 nights. So first we stoked him up with sat down at the dinner table with us, and the eyelids were very heavy, so we directed him downstairs, and he just simply collapsed.
One of the things when single people came in, we had a number of options. We had people who said, I will open my house to people if you think that this is a good thing to do. And we also had the option of the local welfare group, who would make traveler's aid money available, in the sense that they would pay for one night's lodging in our local hotel, which was not the greatest, but it was clean and it was warm. And so very often in sizing up people, we would have to make the decision, is this a person that probably had better go to the hotel, or is it a person, and many times a family, that we should bring into our homes and try to help that way. And it's nice to have those kinds of options available, because not everyone who comes in and calls and needs help is someone that you feel comfortable about bringing into your home, quite frankly. But nonetheless, you feel the importance of helping this person. And two other things I forgot to mention is that we had a food bank that we would ask various congregations in town to give us food that we could give to people in town who'd run out of food, as well as food that could be converted to something edible on the road for families that were stranded there momentarily, wanted to get food and then get rolling again. So we had one person who was responsible for keeping a food bank of basic items, so that when people called for food, we could go to that food bank and have it ready. We also kept a clothing exchange going. In a community town, in our university town, where there are a lot of married students and foreign students, clothing can be a real problem if you're trying to raise a kid and go to graduate school. I mean, it's a real problem if you're a new faculty member and you aren't getting paid much more beyond subsistence wages, which we were getting paid at the time we were in the fish organization. And so we found it very useful to establish a clothing exchange in the basement of our church. And we had people who would bring in clothing clean and in good repair and leave it there. Anybody who needed it could walk in and take what they needed. And we asked them that when they finished with it, if it was still serviceable, put it back or bring in something that their children had outgrown. And this was really a marvelous thing, because we used it for our children for a number of years. And people would come in, some of them on welfare, and we would just go down and say, here are coats, here are dresses, here are boots, take what you need and return. It's not charity. It was very important that we stress this is not charity. We're not just giving it to you, but we expect, you see, this is an exchange, we expect that you will bring something back to the exchange. And that made a great deal of difference to people. because they wanted to feel that they were contributing something, that they weren't just getting all the time. They didn't want charity. And we heard this so many times over the years. People would come in and say, look, I don't want charity. And we would say, well, we aren't giving you charity. This is an exchange. And when people would come in and ask for food or going through town, we'd give them the address and say, all right, when you can, send us some money to pay us back, and we'll put it into the food bank. But we would never charge them for the service. That was something we kept very clear. But we like to give them any way that they had of contributing to the organization. In some instances, people who were helped turned around and became volunteers to help other people when they were able. So that way they gave something of themselves. And that was an important thing, this maintaining human dignity. She ended up in our town because she had a friend there, and the friend had no money to help her, this sort of thing. All right, she came with these children with scant clothing and needed some clothes and household utensils, anything we could get. But she was very difficult to deal with in the sense that she didn't want to be given things like this. She didn't want charity. She didn't want us helping her. And so we made it clear that anything that she could contribute was important because we needed clothes for other people's children too. And she came in, I think, with two dresses and some underwear that she said that they had outgrown. And would this be enough? And I said, you know, it's fine. We really appreciate this. Please just leave it and then take anything you need. Well, she left with about two boxes of clothes. But it was with a different feeling because she felt that she was contributing, and she made the point that as soon as these clothes are outgrown, I'll bring them back to you. And she did. So it was that kind of an option was an important one to offer. It may seem like it's a kind of a superficial thing, but it wasn't to the people that we were dealing with. And we made some marvelous contacts with people that we helped coming through town. Fortunately, we grew up with a background that led us to get along with a lot of different kinds of people. People from classes that a lot of university people have never met or seen before. And this was just part of our background, growing up in a pretty rough part of a big city. So that we didn't feel put off by people who were from, well, the one woman who came through had grown up in a red light district. Yeah. I spent a lot of time in the red light district of Seattle. And she talked pretty rough, and she dressed pretty rough. And a number of people in our organization couldn't handle dealing with somebody like that. So it's important to know those people in your organization who feel at ease with people with other lifestyles, with other backgrounds than their own.
Yeah, this was the one I think I had picked up in the town over in Moscow. She was safely. She had just she'd been kicked out, I think, by a very slight acquaintance. But
and she was crying in a phone booth.
Yeah, and her husband was in a Boise jail for fist fighting in a tavern. And she was about to have an asthmatic attack, which is repeatedly to lay her out. And she was just utterly berserk, hysterical. So I got over there and got her calmed down, and we got her to the house, and we telephoned around, and she kept insisting. What, if necessary, she would peddle her fanny, and she would get bail money to get her husband out. Well, that's not the usual sort of... you know, polite society is not right for that sort of person. But we got her calmed down.
Well, the thing that helped calm her down more than anything else, it was a hot summer day, and we were sitting out on our patio, and we just opened a quart of home brew, which we make, and we had that. And she saw that, and, you know, it's just different world. Yeah. She saw that maybe we were her kind of people or something, I don't know, but she just related well to us. With one glass of beer. I mean, it wasn't as though we were busy, you know, trying to get her drunk, but it just, you know, took that kind of an interaction. But she had quite a story to tell. Yeah. She was with us for most of the day before we made arrangements. And the interesting thing is, before she called us, she'd called another organization in the next town, and they had gotten some mental health people on her to try to find out because she sounded as though she was quite mentally disturbed. And so they had called the mental health people, and they were scrambling, trying to figure out what to do. Well, they finally got one person who would come and see what to do, but that was 6 hours later. She'd been at our house all this time. And finally, we had arranged bus passage for her to get where she was going. She'd calmed down. She was no longer
distraught.
Distraught, and once she was no longer distraught, she no longer seemed unbalanced.
Yeah.
It's just that her vocabulary might have been something that put off a lot of people. And
she's a rough cop.
So by the time they came up with somebody who was going to come over and help her, we already had her on a bus going to where she was
commended
going.
Commended her to the fifth chapter.
In the next town.
So,
with the number, we gave her the number. So as soon as she got there, she made contact with people who would help her at that end, which is why the fish directory was really a helpful thing to have. But I don't know, you just have to be flexible and adaptable and willing to deal with a lot of different kinds
then
of
then finally
people.
there is you won't win them all. Probably the most horrifying call we had, and I think the college kids are past this now, but someone was on a bad trip and I picked the phone up on this one, and I think we had company, and one of the kids was on drugs and was crashing. And this was some house a bunch of students had on the outskirts. And four or five kids, other kids, were hugging this kid as he was literally blowing his mind. And they were just terrified. What were you to do? Now, they needed help, but the help had to be confidential. Because they didn't want the police interfering, because of course, obviously, the police, that's all they have to do is run around, all their other duties, set that aside, to arrest a few kids that are hopped up on who knows what. I tried to get them in touch. We had only two people. Out of 21,000 people in Pullman, there's only two people that have any experience in dealing with kids crashing.
Now, this was before they established the crisis center. I was telling you.
Well, that's another story, because this crisis center doesn't operate when the college isn't in session or during summers, you see. That's the problem with no theological commitment. Well, I talked to him and I said, look, let me get you in touch with this doctor. And they said, no, because the doctor will have to report them to the police. And I said, don't worry about that. We can maintain confidentiality. And they wouldn't let us do anything as far as referral. I put them in touch with we had a chap who was actually doing social work, and whose specialty was the drug counterculture. And his bushy afro and so forth, and he looked very, very far, but he was really straight. He was in disguise, really.
Well, so, he was just effective.
Yeah, and effective. Mm-hmm. And that was the main thing, effective. He spoke the lingo, he knew where it was at. And so finally they did take the guy's a phone number, and whether they went any further, we don't know.
No, but we weren't trained to handle things like that. It was a situation where we didn't really know what to do, except refer him to somebody who could help, and you never know whether the referral worked or not. There's some, you just can't win them all, and you can't brood over the things that you don't handle well. There are always a few things every year where you look back and you think, if I had only done that differently. But fortunately, we have forgiveness for things like that too, and we as an organization have to support each other and say, sometimes you just can't get all of them, you just can't get it right. But most of the time you can, by just being yourself and being really interested and willing to help. And it's very gratifying, to be able to really give something of yourself. It's tempting. A lot of people want to be listening fish at first, because it's a lot less of a trauma to deal with somebody on the phone than it is when you have to go out and see somebody. And when I first started, I felt that way too. It's a lot easier to call up somebody else and say, you go do this. I'll take the call, but you go do it. And finally got to the point when we were on duty one night, and the person who was supposed to be at the other end when I was listening wasn't there. And so I had to go do it. And I remember that first time that I had to go do it. It was quite a wrenching thing, because I walked into a basement apartment, and the girl was playing a song about suicide. I forget what it was. It was a popular song. And it started, imagine there's no heaven, imagine there's no hell. And the way the sound was coming out in her, and she had been drinking heavily. And while I was there, she went into the other room, and I'm pretty sure she was taking some drugs too. And this really worried me because of the combination, because she'd already finished a sizable amount of gin and was to the point of being almost incoherent, but refused to let anybody else come and help her. She refused to let anybody come. And so I went, and I just tried talking to her. And she kept trying to get on the phone a guy that she thought could help her, and the guy was not available. And I was really getting worried, because I had really little experience in dealing with drugs. And I could see that she was getting worse, and I just didn't know what to do about it. So that was just after our crisis center had opened. So finally I said, just go for a walk. So it was raining. We walked out to our car, to my car, and I said, Gideon. And she didn't want to go, but I, you know, by persuading, I finally got her in the car, and then she passed out just after I got in the car. Well, I got her over to the drug center, and I bodily carried her in because I promised her I wouldn't take her to the hospital. And that's a hard thing. When you make that kind of a promise, you feel the necessity for keeping it. And I knew that these people knew how to deal with her. So as soon as I got to the center, I picked her up and carried her in, and they took over right away. And it was such a relief to be able to give her to people who knew how to take care of her. Well, that she'd revived, and by the time I left, things were looking much better because they paired her off with somebody who immediately could relate to her problem, as she was part of a minority group, and this was entering into it too. But she had, you know, a lot of problems. A relative had just died, and she was just getting into one of the power groups in her ethnic group on campus, and this had changed her whole way of looking at things because she came in as a pretty straight, family-oriented person. And so anything that you go into, it seems like there's so many other things that lead into that kind of a call. And it is kind of frightening when you when you go and put yourself on the line that way. But it's also very gratifying when you do see things working out. And you get a good feeling from helping people. And that's what keeps you going in an organization when they call at midnight and you have to get out of bed and go downtown or something.
You always end up having gotten more.
Yeah, we really feel we've always gotten more out of the organization than we ever put into it.
Well, so then you're kind of a county or citywide 24-hour clearinghouse kind of thing. And where the other things do not exist in the community and it's vital enough, then you try and find the way to do it yourselves, to fill the gaps until such time, maybe some. And then what are you also encouraging then other groups to pick up these things?
Right.
Once you've filled the gap, then encourage someone else to take it on. So you're really not, you don't get spread around too thin, but you can still maintain just a crisis clearinghouse thing.
We found that the majority of our calls come in for transportation, just simple transportation from elderly,
arthritic people,
blind students on campus have come to depend heavily on our organization.
Buy a prescription.
And people with it, when there's no public transportation, who don't have a lot of money, just have a lot of need for transportation. The people at Convalescent Center call us to take people to doctor's appointments if they're well enough to go out to doctors. And the next category where we probably get most of our calls are simple are referrals. Where do I go to get this kind of help? Where there is an organization available. Then we get a fair amount of calls to take care of, or for housekeeping, where the mother is sick and the father can't cope with it, he can't afford to hire a housekeeper. And so we have teams, like two or three, that go in and just clean, and that's all there is to it. Or, and probably equal with that, are food, calls for food. People coming in out of money, no money to get food, they need food for the road, so we try to use our food bank, and if there's nothing in the food bank and we don't have enough time to do anything else, we try to get them to come to a home for a meal. You know, like we'll fix an extra part of our dinner or something, but if they don't have time to do that, then the next resort is to actually take them out and buy the meal and take it out of our treasury, which is always on the brink of being empty, or take them to the Safeway store and buy what they need and send them on their way and take it out of our treasury. I remember one really particularly gratifying experience we had when a family came into town in a car that had broken down just out of town. And the guy said, you know, I don't like to ask people for help. But he said, I need some place to fix my car. And I'll fix it myself if you can just get me the tools. And my family hasn't eaten for, I think it was a day and a half. And they had three little children with them. And so we...
This was in a pickup truck.
This was that big, like a Cadillac. It was really funny. It was a big, huge old gas hog of a car. But anyway, we have a place in town where you can go and fix your car. You can put it up on the hoist, a do-it-yourself kind of place. And we had a guy in our organization who was pretty good with cars. So we put the two of them in touch, and he fixed his car. And we found a place for the family to stay. And that night, it was late. I mean, like 11 or 12 o'clock. And so we just took them out to a restaurant and sat and talked to them. And in talking to them, we found out that we were just passing on something that they had already done, because this guy was from the East, and I got to talking to his wife, and I really believe she was telling me the truth, because I remembered reading about this, that there was a school bus accident back there, and they had been driving by on the freeway just after this accident happened, and her husband had been one of the first to the school bus and had gotten on the bus and had gotten the kids off just before the bus burned and had himself gotten burned in the process. And so that makes you feel particularly good when you can help somebody who's already helped somebody else. It's kind of like passing it along, you know. And you never know who's going to drive into your town in that kind of a situation. You never know when you yourself will be in that situation. So it's a worthwhile thing if your community needs a service like this, to be one of the people that helps to get it started, or just one of the people who helps to keep it going.